From the Denker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, current events, and issues that matter to you. I'm your host, Roger McDonough. Coming up today on the show, we're going to begin the first in a two-part look at domestic violence in the state of Utah with Jen Oxborough, Domestic Violence Program Administrator for the Utah Department of Human Services, and Kendra Wyckoff, Executive Director for the Utah Domestic Violence Coalition.
One of the most important components to basically resolving some of these issues in our society, it's creating awareness, and not just awareness amongst people who may be victims of domestic violence, but among our communities.
That discussion, a look at Medicaid expansion alternatives during our Better Utah legislative recap, and your top local headlines, including the latest showdown over the so-called Zion Curtain, just ahead on The Rundown here on KCPW. And welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up a little bit later on the show, we'll begin the first in a two-part look at domestic violence in the state of Utah. But first up, we have these headlines. Protesters pushing for Utah to adopt a statewide anti-discrimination law protecting sexual and gender orientation returned to the state capitol Wednesday to advocate for their cause. At a news conference and rally, the group called out lawmakers for refusing to hear the bill. The protesters were arrested at the Capitol 3 weeks ago when they blocked several committee rooms to draw attention to Senate Bill 100. That bill, which would bar discrimination in housing and employment, has been stalled this session. Republican leaders at the legislature have called for a moratorium on any issues they fear could affect the state's pending legal challenge over its same-sex marriage ban. St. George Republican Senator Steve Urquhart, who is sponsoring the proposal, says that it has nothing to do with same-sex marriage. A total of 27 groups, organizations, and coalitions have filed Friend of the Court briefs urging a federal appeals court to legalize gay marriage in Utah and Oklahoma. In addition to a group of Western Republicans and National Associations of Sociologists and Psychologists, an argument was also submitted before the Tuesday midnight deadline by a coalition of companies, including Starbucks, eBay, Facebook, and Google. Last month, 26 groups filed Friend of the Court briefs asking the federal court to uphold same-sex marriage bans in the two states. Hearings are set for mid-April before the Denver-based 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. The judges must decide if they agree with federal judges in Utah and Oklahoma who ruled the state same-sex marriage bans violate the constitutional rights of gay and lesbian couples. And finally today, few issues crystallize the alcohol debate in Utah better than the so-called Zion Curtain. Supporters deem it a necessary protection for families at restaurants. Detractors say that it does little to prevent drinking and that it's a bit weird. Despite the controversy surrounding this uniquely Utah dispute, the near-annual Zion Curtain bill has made its way back to the Utah legislature again. And yesterday's committee hearing on the bill was as contentious as you might expect. To bring us all the highlights, here's KCPW's Ryan Cunningham with more.
If you live in Utah, you probably know what a Zion Curtain is, but here's a quick refresher. In most restaurants that serve alcoholic beverages, they are required to set up a partition where those beverages are prepared, thus preventing restaurant patrons from viewing the preparation of said beverages. That partition is known as a Zion Curtain, a satirical mashup of the Iron Curtain and a reference to the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The LDS Church has been an outspoken opponent of alcohol consumption for years. Utah is the only state that enforces such a law, and those in the restaurant and tourism industry say the rule can be unfair to some businesses and confusing for patrons. That's why Republican Representative Craig Powell has brought HB 285 to the Utah legislature this year. His bill would give every alcohol-serving restaurant the option to remove the Zion Curtain if they instead post a sign near the entrance that warns customers that alcohol is served at the establishment. The bill would also restrict minors from dining in lounge or bar areas, which would be a new restriction. The House Revenue and Taxation Committee had a heated exchange after Powell's presentation. Republican Representative Jacob Anderegg says this is a matter of protecting kids from alcohol, no matter what anyone thinks of the Zion Curtain.
I think we have a fundamental right in the state to protect our kids. Is the Zion's wall perfect? No. Do I personally think it's stupid? Yes. But I cannot say that in good conscience I'm okay blurring the lines. And I have to vote against this bill.
Some committee members, like Republican Representative Doug Sagers, were frustrated that alcohol policy reform seems to come up time and time again.
In 2009, SB 187 was passed by both bodies of the legislature and became law. This confirmed important operational differences between restaurants on one hand and bars on the other hand. It is driven by the concept that a restaurant should appear not like a bar or have the atmosphere of a bar, and that the culture of drinking that exists in a bar should not be present in a restaurant. A short 5 years later, we're back with the same group requesting to change the law again.
But after being grilled by his colleagues, Powell came back with some bite of his own.
I agree with Representative Anderig, Representative Tanner, Representative Sager. We want bars to be bars and restaurants to be restaurants. And here's my answer to all of you. Guess what? Have you ever been in a real bar? It's not a restaurant. All restaurants must maintain sales of 70% of food. I talk to all my constituents, and I would ask you to talk to your constituents who drink alcohol as well. They do not go to restaurants in order to have a bar experience or in order to consume alcohol. Just like you and I do, they go to restaurants to do what? To eat. But guess what? There are many people in this world and many people in Utah that it is customary when they eat to also drink alcohol.
Before voting on the bill, Sakers reiterated his worry that tearing down the Zion Curtain would be problematic for Utah families trying to avoid exposure to alcohol.
I was amused by some of the comments I heard today. One is, if you don't want to go to a restaurant that serves liquor, go somewhere else. Well, this bill's about driving revenue. Well, McDonald's, Arby's, Wendy's can save a lot of business. I just hope they have fine dining with linen and table and candles for me and my wife.
But Powell urged the committee to set aside their personal biases when considering alcohol legislation.
We don't actually see what other people see because we're not other people. And so as we here, as non-drinkers, make legislative policy for alcohol, I think we always need to do so with a large dose of reservation, wondering exactly if we really understand the implications of the policy that we're passing.
Powell's HB 285 squeaked out of the House Revenue and Taxation Committee by an 8-7 vote. It'll be heard next on the House floor, where it's certain to face substantial scrutiny. From the Capitol, I'm Ryan Cunningham for KCPW News.
And did you ever wonder where the term Zion Curtain, as it applies to alcohol policy in Utah, originated? We did some digging and found a 2007 Salt Lake Tribune article quoting then-Liquor Control Commissioner Bobby Corey, who coined the term for a partition that would have hidden bottles of alcohol from patrons in restaurants. The term now describes a barrier behind which booze must be mixed and poured in restaurants. And now you know. That does it for our local headlines today. You're listening to The Rundown here on KCPW. Stay with us. It's time once again for our Better Utah Legislative Recap with Marianne Martindale, Executive Director of the nonprofit Good Government Group Alliance for a Better Utah. Marianne, maybe we could dig into the health coverage proposals, the sort of Medicaid expansion alternatives that are on the table out there. Governor Herbert had proposed this block grant, no strings attached, federal money solution. What's going on with that?
Yeah, so it's a little bit tricky because we have things in play during the legislative session, and then we have the governor's proposal. So really, there's three things on the table. There's Speaker Lockhart's plan, which is HB 401, which is no federal money in any way, shape, or form, and only covering maybe 50,000. I mean, it's actually kind of unclear a little bit because it's based on like the most urgent need. It would all be money, state money. So, you know, probably $35 to $40 million is a conservative estimate. Mm. The second bill is SB 251 by Senator Brian Shiozawa. So that's in the Senate. That's a kind of a combination. It's still only covering up to 100% of the poverty level, which would be about 54,000 Utahns. But it would be using federal money to do that. Mostly through sort of like the alternate coverage in order to get the insurance through the private market.
Right.
And then the third plan is Governor Gary Herbert's plan, or Healthy Utah Plan, as they've labeled it. And that would cover up to 133% of the poverty level, which would be 111,000 people. So it's, you know, essentially twice as many people. So you have those three different plans. Two of them are in the legislature.
Does the governor's plan end up getting into the legislature somehow, into legislation, or do we know that?
So far, there hasn't been any indication that there's anyone who's wanting to step up and run it. And frankly, I'm not sure it would succeed anyway. You know, you have one plan in the House, you have one plan in the Senate. And, you know, what could happen, and this is, of course, just a could be, is the House, they could pass that plan, but it could languish in the Senate and never pass. The Senate could pass their plan, and that could languish in the House and never pass. Mm. And we could conceivably see the legislature expire a week from this Thursday, without passing either of those two things.
At which point does the governor just get to make a decision? I mean, it is his call, kind of.
Yes and no. So because we're really late to the game on Medicaid expansion. I mean, if anybody's paid attention, we're one of the last states that's making a decision one way or the other.
Right.
And technically we basically just said no to Medicaid expansion, although, you know, we'll take the money, but we want to do it our way. So, you know, it's kind of a yes with caveats, no with caveats, however you want to put it.
Maybe a political reality kind
right.
of.
Right. Yeah. But because we came to this so late, last year the discussion in the legislature was all about how do we control what happens. Mm. The governor had indicated that he was not in any hurry to try to make a decision on this. He wasn't going to decide anything right away. And so the legislature passed a bill that said that ultimately they have to approve to allocate any money and give sort of some type of an approval to any plan that is decided on.
Right.
So what could happen then if we see the legislature end on the 13th at midnight and there's no bill passed and then the governor says, okay, time for my plan,
proposal, actually. Yeah.
He could essentially put it into play and he could call them into a special session
sure.
to, you know, give the thumbs up and to allocate any money that might be needed to set it up initially and so forth.
Well, so that's something that we may see happen. We're not certain. It just depends on whether or not one of these other legislative proposals makes it out. If it does make it out, if it is, approved by the full legislature and it'll go to the governor's desk, do you think he's likely to veto that?
I think he would veto it. I mean, I think that would be a fairly safe bet where his plan is so completely different than either of the two that are on the table. I think the likelihood of a veto is high.
And he's called one of them at least illogical.
Right. And that's HB 401, the speaker's plan, because it's so minimal and it is all it's turning your back on any federal money whatsoever. It's going to be interesting. I mean, there's a lot of political goings on between this back and forth between the speaker and between Governor Herbert. And it's going to be it's almost a little bit of a game of chicken.
Yeah. Well, I guess as usual, we just have to wait and see with the clock running out.
Yeah, we run out of time. So there's still a lot of political posturing, but, you know, the clock's ticking. So at some time, we're going to have to get a decision on one of these things sooner or later.
All right. Marianne, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
Marianne Martindale is the executive director of the nonprofit Good Government Group Alliance for a Better Utah. She joins us daily during the legislative session for our Better Utah legislative recap. You're listening to The Rundown here on KCPW. We'll be right back. Although the definitions and measurements vary among the states, domestic violence, also referred to as intimate partner violence, continues to be prevalent in the U.S. and here in Utah. But while there has been a documented 40% increase in stays in domestic violence shelters in the state over the past 5 years, state funding for these services hasn't increased. With the state legislature currently considering a proposal to augment the amount of money going to domestic violence services, we thought we'd take a deeper look at this issue. I'm joined today by Jen Oxborough, Domestic Violence Program Administrator for the Utah Department of Human Services, and by Kendra Wyckoff, Executive Director of the Utah Domestic Violence Coalition, for the first in a two-part discussion. Thanks to you both for coming in today and speaking with me.
Thanks for having us.
Domestic violence, to me, seems almost like a sanitized term for the abuse that occurs in families and relationships. And so I thought before we go any further, maybe we could get kind of a simple, if there is such a thing, definition of what domestic violence actually refers to.
I think you're right. The term domestic violence is one that we've kind of become immune to. It encompasses really a multitude of relationships. One that we specifically focus on is intimate partner relationships, but it can include other types of familial relationships or folks that are living together in different types of relationships. When we talk about domestic violence, though, what people often respond to or what they're hearing or what they identify with is that physical abuse piece, and it's much more comprehensive. There are other elements of abuse happening in the relationship, and it's very much a pattern of control. It's very systemic. It's something that an abusive partner uses on a daily basis, ranging from psychological abuse, emotional abuse, spiritual abuse, physical and sexual violence. So a victim of domestic violence is often experiencing abuse at many levels in the relationship. And we don't always identify with that. What we identify with is, you know, the bruises or broken bones when we talk about domestic violence.
Right. Those are the outward signs, the things you can recognize. But often, we're not just talking about physical violence. That can be there, but also domestic violence. You might not even have physical violence.
Correct.
So I've lived and worked in several other states, and I think that Utah actually does a pretty good job of defining legally cohabitant abuse. And it gets at many of the things that Kendra just explained. So In Utah, our statute and the way that we look at this legally is under the guise of the Cohabitant Abuse Act, and so that encompasses more than just intimate partners. And it does specify that domestic violence can also, and cohabitant abuse can also include psychological and emotional abuse, which is great when you look at a child welfare perspective. It gives us some empowerment to do what we need to do sometimes to help people attain safety.
Having that legal framework is important, is the idea.
Right.
How about, let's talk about maybe how big of a problem that this is. I've read that statistically more than 1 in 3 women report having been a victim of domestic violence. And I'm wondering how in the state of Utah we compare with the rest of the states.
So it's difficult, and you jump in here whenever you want to. It's difficult to compare apples to apples when you're talking about domestic violence. Each state defines domestic violence and cohabitant abuse uniquely. And so we were just talking about this earlier. To me, it's helpful to get us all speaking a sort of universal language when we're looking at data. And so I tend to rely on the CDC data. The Center for Disease Control puts out an intimate partner violence report, the most recent report that was issued in 2012 and then reissued with addendums, is capturing data up through 2010. And that shows that our prevalence here in Utah is about 1 in 3 women, where nationally about 1 in 4 women would be impacted by intimate partner violence in their lifetime. So while each state defines it differently, if you look at the national statistics out of the CDC with a standardized definition, Utah is faring worse than the national average according to that CDC data.
Is there any thinking as to why the prevalence is higher here in the state as opposed to other places?
Sure. To me, I think that we have some real issues regarding access to care. Our systems of care are at capacity. Our behavioral health care system, our victim services system, our treatment provision is really at capacity, and it makes it very difficult for people who have a need for care and emergency safety issues. It makes it difficult for them to get care. I think there's also a lack of awareness. So I so appreciate you being interested in talking with us today about this, because I think most people in Utah feel like it's a really safe place. And in many ways, I think it is. But regarding violence against women in particular, we have some alarming rates and trends. And our child maltreatment rate is actually higher than the national average as well. So I think bringing awareness to this is really key. Why does it happen? I think lack of awareness. Why does it happen continually or repeatedly? I think lack of access to services and some problems with our funding, which we're working on.
Well, yeah, I absolutely agree with Jen. I also think that domestic violence and sexual violence, these are topics that folks are just not really comfortable talking about. Our communities often really view these issues as private matters. And as the state coalition, we try to raise awareness that this isn't a private matter. This is a public matter. It's a public health issue. It's a public safety issue. And by bringing that awareness up and having dialogues and conversations, we're able to really understand what are the gaps, what are the needs of victims in our state and their children, and help try to be solution focused. And one of those things that we are doing is working closely with the Department of Human Services and recognizing that accessibility to services is very significant gap in our state right now, and has been for some time. Mm-hmm. And that is a significant issue. And as we work together, we hope to see that more people are able to access victim services in the state.
You know, it's amazing to hear of how much of this there is. And, I feel like we're almost taking for granted the idea that it happens in our society, and that treatment is lacking in general. But also we're taking for granted the sort of basic underlying idea that it just happens. Is there any work being done, and maybe you guys aren't the people to ask this, but on the causes, you know, the things that allow this to happen in our society?
Right.
Well, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's a lot of prevention efforts that are happening. I think that prevention is one of the most important components to basically resolving some of these issues in our society. It's creating awareness, and not just awareness amongst people who may be victims of domestic violence, but amongst our communities, amongst, you know, healthcare providers, amongst teachers, amongst other groups that can address issues when we're seeing issues within our families and with children in our schools or within other types of settings. So many of the domestic violence victim service providers in the state, particularly the nonprofit organizations, do much intervention work, but there's a great deal of prevention work that they do as well.
The state coalition, Kendra's organization, has really helped me over the years to understand that when we talk about primary prevention, we aren't just trying to prevent victims from being victimized, we're trying to prevent the violence from happening, mm-hmm. from being perpetrated. And so moving away from a victim blaming, why did that mm-hmm. happen to her or him, thinking more and shifting awareness in our communities about alternatives to violent communication, violent behavior, power and control dynamics in relationships, how that primary prevention piece is so important at a community level to help people understand how to prevent the violence from happening first and foremost. And so I really hope with some of our primary prevention efforts throughout the state that we start to look at stronger bystander intervention programs, teaching our kids how to communicate well, how to avoid bullying, how to avoid teen dating violence, and how to raise awareness about healthy relationships and what to do. Factors that promote resiliency and promote just better communication and relationships overall. That prevention piece is key. It often gets pushed aside because we're so underfunded in our victim service area. We're struggling to keep our heads above water there.
Well, and that's unnecessary. I mean, you have to deal with victim services because they're there.
And it's immediate need.
Yeah, immediate mm-hmm. need. A lot of this goes unreported. Is that correct?
That's correct. At the state coalition, we have a 24-hour hotline that's confidential and anonymous. And the majority of the folks that are calling in on that hotline are folks that are not reporting to law enforcement. For victims of domestic violence, it sometimes can increase risk. There's many reasons why they choose not to report, because they're just not in a place where that system of care may be able to help them. They feel like that may create additional barriers and burdens for them.
So let's talk about funding of services. I'm just looking at this. 13 private domestic violence shelters have managed to house more than 41% more mm-hmm. survivors, going from 76,767 shelter nights in 2008 to 108,377 shelter nights in 2012. That's providing a lot more for the same amount of money.
Right. So we have made some small advancements to the amount of funding that we pass through to our victim service providers and emergency shelters, but it's small and it's not keeping up with the need. The data that you're referencing comes from the shelter providers and the Department of Human Services. As we were analyzing our provision of care, we saw that from 2008 to 2012, these private shelters that we contract with to pass through state and federal funds dedicated to victim services, those shelters, those 13 private shelters, somehow managed to provide 41% more events of service with pretty much flat funding.
Are there private donors coming in, or what's happening to allow that to happen?
I think that they're managing it. We were looking at this pretty closely. It's pretty remarkable that with really limited funds, they've been able to expand the number of volunteer hours. They've really gone out and recruited more philanthropic support, and they're working with fundraising, and they're very savvy, and they're spending a lot of time trying to bring in enough financial support to keep their doors open. But they continue to be at capacity. During that same period of time, even though they provided 41%, they expanded their care by 41%, we turned away 67% more people in 2012 than we did in 2008.
That shows a pretty big increase.
So we're seeing more people seeking services, but we're also seeing people with unmet needs. So that unmet need is very concerning to us, and it's a big reason we're working together closely to try to secure more funding and then make sure that the programs that we're using are evidence-based and providing the best care to people.
When those people are turned away, when that 67% is turned away because they're at capacity, that's it? They can't find service, and where do they go?
Well, we're hoping that no one is turned away. Right. We're hoping that they're being referred to other services, but they're really, other services are at capacity too.
And that's the challenge, is that, you know, these programs, we don't like that, you know, the terminology turned away. We like to express it in unmet need, because the reality is these programs are doing the best that they can to support those folks that they may not be able to bring into emergency shelter because they're at capacity. They're connecting them with other programs across the state. They may be connecting them with the hotline or other types of systems of care to meet their needs. But, you know, the reality is that most of those systems, and in particular the victim service programs, are at capacity. And so although they are reaching out trying to connect with another program, another shelter maybe, that shelter oftentimes is at capacity as well. So it's extremely challenging. And then when we look at the geographic region, when you have somebody who's trying to access a safe place in the northern part of the state, if the only space that may be available for emergency shelter is in Washington County, the reality is folks cannot get there. They right. don't have the means, the transportation. It takes them away from their support systems. And so that's why we're really looking mm-hmm. at this issue and saying, what can we do better? How do we address the need? How do we offer more comprehensive services in our communities? And how do we increase funding to support these programs that are trying so hard to meet the needs of their communities and victims and their children?
And again, I've been speaking with Jen Oxborough, Domestic Violence Program Administrator for the Utah Department of Human Services, and Kendra Wyckoff, Executive Director of the Utah Domestic Violence Coalition. This is the first in a two-part series. Tomorrow we'll continue the discussion and focus especially on the services available to people in need of help. I'm Roger McDonough, and you're listening to The Rundown. We'll be right back. And thanks again for tuning into The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis, Ryan Cunningham, and Mr. Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tomorrow on the program, we'll get part two of our focus on domestic violence, looking in particular at the help that is available for those who need it. Between now and then, follow the program on Twitter. Our handle is at @KCPWRundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are next.